The violence continued unabated today, with Israeli occupation forces continuing to shoot children, demolish houses, and steal Palestinian land. And Palestinians continue to respond by strapping bombs to their bodies and sacrificing their lives and the safety of their families by blowing themselves up in Israeli cities in the name of Palestinian liberation. In one moment, we'll be joined in the studio by Hawaita Araf and Adam Shapiro, two prominent members of the international solidarity movement. But first, we go to an interview recorded just before airtime with Anne Gwynn. A British member of the ISM called us from the back of an ambulance as it wove through the streets of Nablus, dodging Israeli tanks and random gunfire. Gwynn began by comparing what she was seeing to Germany after the war.
A city which looks like Berlin at the end of the war, with rubble everywhere. We are traveling in an ambulance through bombed houses, huge trenches in the road, lakes of water, seas of mud, roadblocks, hundreds and hundreds of cars which have been crushed by tanks, hundreds of cars which have been shelled, bombed, burnt out. I'm just passing a house on the left where 9 people were killed because they did not get warning to get out. This is typical. We are now taking a detour. All the rumbling and bumps that you can hear are the ambulance trying to negotiate the torn up roads, the piles of rubble, the trenches dug to effectively prevent ambulances from getting injured people to hospital in one piece. Tonight, we have had 6 or 7 calls so far in the last 3 hours. It takes you a very long time to get to a call because you have to make detours of miles because the tanks are blocking the roads with their guns. We were stopped with one tank, gun pointing towards us. We were stopped there for 15 minutes. Then it swiveled its gun away, and presumably we were allowed to go. We went, and we were not shot. The ambulance has bullet holes in it. The handles of the stretcher have bullet holes in the handles of the stretcher. Whoever heard of such a thing? Earlier this evening, we were traveling to take a young child who had been shot with a plastic bullet in his head to hospital. We saw an ambulance belonging to the C101 group, not ours, parked in a side street. It looked in a funny place, parked especially. On the way back, a group of young men who are our lookouts telling us where the troops are stopped us, told us that ambulance was stolen from its crew who were held captive in the back and was an ambush for anyone stopping to find out what was wrong. It was full of soldiers. I was just blown away. But Dr. Rassan, he is the director of MRC in Nablus, he said, oh, it's normal, that happens all the time. I checked with them what we should do if our ambulance is ambushed. If I, as an international, could stop it by saying, look, I'm a UK citizen, you can't take this ambulance. They said they will just beat you and tie you up in the back, so please just get out and throw the keys as far as possible.
Anne Gwynn, this is Dennis Bernstein. Talk to you from Berkeley Pacifica Radio. You're in this ambulance now. Is there firing? Have the Israelis opened fire on Nablus?
No, not shells, but we can hear sporadic fighting. An aircraft dropped one bomb this afternoon. We do not know exactly where that bomb was dropped because we couldn't see the aircraft. It was too high. We heard the tanks roll in. They are surrounding the town, but so far they are not expecting anything until 2 o'clock in the morning. That is when it usually happens. We are told that the martyr's house will be blown up either tonight or tomorrow night. They know who they are because every single citizen of Palestine has 10 fingers printed on record. So when they find one finger of a martyr, they can identify him. That's how they demolish the houses so quickly and so easily. The family will be deported to Gaza, dumped in the street where they know no one, no support, grieving for their children who were 17 and 19 years old, had no past, no present, no future, no marriage, no job, no marriage to look forward to, no children, no normal life like everybody else.
Obviously, there was a terrible bombing in Tel Aviv. Many people were killed. Many people were wounded. I guess the people were expecting some kind of response. Help us understand how people where you are respond to this kind of bombing in Tel Aviv.
During the last 4 weeks, 55 residents of Nablus have been killed for no reason at all. Most of them civilians, many of them children, all shot in the shoulders, neck, and head. And these actions, regrettable though they are, all of them, of course, on both sides, are a retaliation for 55 helpless residents of Nablus, whom nobody is listening to, who were just simply shot for no reason during the past 3 weeks to 4 weeks. There is not a single journalist in this place, not one. Not one foreign journalist, and it's safe as houses for us, of course. We are not Palestinian. We are fine, other than an accidental shooting. They did shoot an international in the main street yesterday who was attending to a small child who had been shot in the head with a rubber bullet.
The child who was shot in the head was shot before the bombing?
It was yesterday, and the bombing was last night.
Keep telling us what you see outside the ambulance.
As we are now, okay, we have arrived back at our station, which is in the middle of a devastated street. To the right, there's a kind of bombed-out house on the corner, and there's a barricade of concrete blocks across the street. The bottom is a complete wasteland, which is a huge main boulevard. This is a very elegant city with tree ferns like Berkeley. Very beautiful city with dual carriageway boulevards. It's got pillared parades of shops for like a half a mile or a mile at a time. Very, very beautiful. Very much like Berkeley. Houses rise to the top of mountains on all sides with lights just shining. It's just unbelievably beautiful here at night when you can't actually see all the rubble. At the bottom of this wide road that comes in the main street, it has just been trashed completely. The heaps of rubble, concrete blocks. You cannot tell when you're back there where you are trying to go.
Okay, we're losing you now. And that is where we lost Anne Gwynn, in that ambulance, back of that ambulance in Nablus, in the occupied West Bank. And the situation continues apace. Now joining us in the studio is Hawida Araf and Adam Shapiro, both with the International Solidarity Movement. The two are key activists in the ISM. They work very hard and diligently to end the occupation. They're in the U.S. Talking about the situation, trying to raise consciousness and get support for the movement to free Palestine. I want to welcome both of you together in the studio. Usually I've got one of you or one of you here and one of you there, so it's really good to have you both together.
Thank you.
And you are a couple, right? You know each other. How did you two meet?
In April of 2000, I went over to Jerusalem to accept a job as a program coordinator with a conflict resolution program, an American-based conflict resolution program that had an office in Jerusalem. It was called Seeds of Peace, and they had a center for coexistence in Jerusalem. I accepted a job as a program coordinator, and Adam was the director at the time.
And you began to work together in Seeds of Peace?
Yes, we worked together for about a year before I actually resigned. The situation was too much to only focus on dialogue and not take action. You know, as an employee with Seeds of Peace, for example, I would see great injustices being committed by the Israeli government against Palestinians, and I would not be allowed to take action. For example, a home demolition. Of course, I would want to protest or put my body in front of this home to prevent it from being demolished, but I could not do that. We focus on dialogue and not action. And with as desperate as the situation got, I couldn't do that anymore.
Well, let's talk about the situation, which is probably as bad now as it's ever been. And part of the defining information there has to do with the use of the 9/11 attacks by the current Israeli government to turn it against Palestinians and to broad brush every Palestinian as a dangerous terrorist. And there is a tremendous linkage between the impending war against Iraq and what's going on in Israel. And I wanted to talk a little bit about how you see that linkage.
Well, first, I think we have to acknowledge that we keep on finding milestones by which to measure how much worse things are getting for Palestinians. First, it was Sharon's election and the shift from Barak to Sharon, even before Sharon was elected, Palestinians were being killed on a daily basis by heavy Israeli weaponry. And then after Sharon was elected, it was the September 11th events, which gave Sharon the green light to go ahead and accelerate his program of killing and wiping out Palestinians. And now we're talking about a potential war with Iraq, which everybody acknowledges, even Israeli academics and citizens in Israel, that the Israeli government will use as a pretext for escalating the war on the Palestinian people. And what most people fear is that this will be used as an opportunity, the way the Israeli government sees it, to basically ethnically cleanse the Palestinians and force the population either out of the West Bank and Gaza completely, or perhaps a smaller scale version is to sort of squeeze the Palestinian population into a smaller area in the West Bank in particular and annex the rest of the land for the Israeli state. There talk of this kind of population transfer or ethnic cleansing goes on every single day in the Israeli cabinet meetings. There are many cabinet ministers in the current government in Israel, and potentially even more should Sharon win another election, that advocate this as policy every single day. And even in this country, in the United States, people in Congress have been on record as saying that they support the population transfer of the Palestinians.
Hoveda, is there a real fear on the ground now that there will in fact be this kind of purge and that there will be the complete steal?
Well, we see it all the time, or I could say more recently, in the past few months, with all of the talk in the media focus on what's happening in Iraq with the weapons inspections and with the Bush administration's moves towards a possible strike on Iraq, there hasn't been much focus on what's happening in Israel-Palestine. And we've seen another escalation, as Adam has talked about, of the Sharon government attacking Palestinians. Just last week, there was demolition of 25 Palestinian refugee homes in Gaza. I didn't see one mention of it. I only knew by our activists that are there, but I didn't see one mention of it in any mainstream television news program or a mainstream newspaper. And so the people definitely know that the journalists will be taken away, will focus on other things. It's hard enough as it is to get journalists to come into the occupied territories. Israel makes it very difficult for them by all of the roadblocks and checkpoints. So it's hard enough to travel into these areas. And then sometimes when journalists do make an effort to travel, soldiers say, you know, it's a closed military zone, you're not allowed to enter. So it's very, very few journalists. And many of them that decide to come with the ISM and our alternative news source journalists that will make the extra effort to travel and to get the story. Palestinians know this. They know they're in trouble. They have been in trouble, and that will only escalate. And they're trying to prepare at least mentally for the worst. For someone listening from outside, it's probably, if we sit there and detail to you what happens daily, it's probably hard to imagine that it will get any worse.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, my name is Dennis Bernstein. That's the voice of Hoveda Raf and Adam Shapiro. They are prominent leaders of the International Solidarity Movement, and we are talking about the continued illegal occupation based on international law, based on UN resolutions. I guess it must get, to put it mildly, frustrating to hear the dual standard being put forward. Resolutions before the UN are being are the things that are justifying the so-called attack on Iraq. When it comes to Israel, they're ignored. If it's nuclear weapons, Israel's got several hundred, but they need to get the inspectors into Iraq or they need to bomb. I guess a way that this drives you mad.
It is very frustrating, and it is this kind of frustration of working through the formal bodies calling for protection, for example, for Palestinians, calling for the United Nations, our respective governments to take action to uphold international law, and being frustrated by basically the United States mainly turning its back on Palestinian human rights, that has led us to reach out to civilians in all these countries. And the civilians that come over, and many of them have been Americans, and a good percentage of them have even been American Jews that are frustrated with Israel's, basically Israel's violence against Palestinians, and that average Americans that are frustrated by American foreign policy that have stepped up, decided to come to the occupied territories and do what the formal bodies that should be doing these things, protecting civilians, upholding human rights, they weren't doing it. And so civilians now are doing it. And we heard the voice of Anne Quinn, one of them, accompanying an ambulance because Palestinian ambulances aren't allowed to operate. And the Red Cross does nothing about it. I remember when we were in the siege, during the siege in April, where we were trying to assist Palestinian medical workers in the occupied territories. Ramallah was under curfew for 9 straight days, and Palestinian medical workers were trying to deliver food to people that couldn't come out of their homes. We didn't see one UN truck until the siege was lifted. Or the Red Cross, we were calling them. They say, sorry, we can't do anything because the Israelis refuse to coordinate and cooperate. So we really need civilians, first of all, to take action, hopefully to shame their governments, and then and to open the eyes of other civilians, the Americans, to talk to the other Americans about what our government is doing. What is this war in Iraq really about? Why do we continue to give Israel $3 billion a year in military aid that's used against civilians? So it is frustrating, but the action of average civilians is really heartening, and it's really what keeps us moving forward.
Well, I want you to take a crack at this, Adam, but it is important to note that the Israelis are in Washington today asking for another $4 billion with no strings attached, not like there were any attached to the other, whatever, how many billions. But they're in there with some pretty significant individuals asking for that money.
Well, it seems that Israel considers the United States sort of, the rich uncle to come in and ask for money whenever it feels like it, whenever it needs to. Israel's economy, of course, is not nearly as good as it once was these days, and it's feeling the pinch. And so Israel is seeking funds from wherever it can, and it knows it can go to the United States. Now, the big secret is to the American taxpayer that the amount of aid going to Israel every year far exceeds anything we're spending in this country on American citizens. And I think it's high time that American citizens woke up, became aware of the amount of money we're spending, and not just spending money, but where that money is specifically going. It's going to feed another country's military, a military who, this government considers an ally. And yet this ally, the United States has already asked them not to participate in a war against Iraq. If we're going to carry out a war against Iraq, you would think that you would ask your allies to join you. This administration, as all previous administrations have known, is that Israel is not an ally. It's in fact a liability for action, for support. And so while we serve Israel's interests, American citizens serve Israel's interests very much, Israel certainly does not serve America's interests.
I keep thinking of this song by Pete Seeger, Inch by Inch, Row by Row, We're Going to Make the Whatever Grow. And I'm thinking about Gaza and Kristen Chu, who was reporting to us last weekend. It's like row by row, they're knocking down the houses and they're stealing the land, whether the people are in the houses or not in the houses. And it really is an amazing situation to know this and to see what comes through in the networks. We're going to do something that we don't typically do. We're going to spend a few minutes. We're going to open up the telephones here. And if you have a question for Haweda or Adam, you can give us a call at – and I'm going to be very strict with you. If you have a question for Adam or Haweda, you can inform it, but I'm not interested in big speeches. It's rare that we have a chance to have them in the studio. So if you've got a specific question that you have for Adam or for Haweda, so we're going to – go to the first call, and you are listening to Flashpoints, and I believe we do have the first call. And Jeff in Oakland, that's you.
Thank you, Dennis, and really much heartfelt congratulations to your guests. My point is also, I would like to interject that when you say, is America or is Israel serving America's interests, I would like to put it in the context of the national security state, the alliance between Mossad and CIA, and the dirty work that Mossad has done all over the world in decades past. And also, in terms of the aid itself, I think probably, I would say hypothetically...
Jeff, and the question is... Jeff, the question is... I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yes, I would say the greatest lobbying force for giving the aid to Israel would in fact be Lockheed and the other weapons manufacturers, because that takes an overwhelming form in which the aid is given,
right,
and it doesn't go to the people. Thank you.
Adam, Lockheed Martin.
Well, I think it is true that to just simply look at the American Jewish lobby and point to that as the only source of influence and sort of impact on Congress is missing the point. I think your caller is correct in looking at the arms industry and the arms manufacturers.
All right, we're going to go to Aaron in San Francisco. That's you.
Hello.
That's you.
Hi, my question is for Adam. It's a very simple one, and Adam, I really respect your work, and I'm wondering, what would you say to the families of the 23 or 24 victims of yesterday's suicide bombing?
Thank you, caller.
Thank you.
I would say to those families, as I've said to other families who I know personally who've had people killed and injured by these horrific bombings, that I extend my sympathies and empathies to them, and I give them whatever mental and emotional support I can. I think that these people need to be supported by their family and by their loved ones and by the entire world. Nobody should have to die in this conflict, nobody whatsoever, because this conflict will not end by the number of people killed on either side. And what I would urge is that these family members and all the family members of all the victims push their respective sides, but in particular, since we're talking about the Israeli victims, to push their government to do what it needs to do to end the occupation, end the oppression of the Palestinian people, for that's the only way to break the current reality that we have.
All right, we're going to go on to another call. We've got Bronston in Sacramento. By the way, you both are going to be speaking in Sacramento tomorrow night, and tonight you're going to be at New College here in the Bay Area. I think it's 763 Valencia at 7 p.m. Bronston, you're on the air.
My dear friends, you're wonderful, and I want to just say, ask, really. I don't understand why there is always such restraint in the language that is used to describe what is going on. It seems to me that we're in the grip of a fascist aggression, that genocide is being carried out, that the Zionist ideology of removal of non-Jews or non-Zionists from the ground is very explicit and clear, but those three things really don't get injected into the language of the description of what's going on, and it seems to me somewhat weak, and I don't understand why at some point or points as we talk about this day after day after day, that we don't use words that really draw the line sharply. And if you could help me understand that, I would appreciate it.
Wait, do you want to take a crack at that?
Sure. Especially in the U.S. for a long time, and it continues today, that Americans are not given the truth when it comes to reporting by, our journalists. Like I said before, the mainstream media does not do what's happening in Israel-Palestine justice. And so most Americans are either ignorant or confused about what's happening in the Middle East. And some would, at best, they would put Israel and the Palestinians on a level playing field and they're fighting over the same piece of land. And that's not the case. We have a case of an occupation force that is carrying out or using brute military might against the people that they occupy in an attempt to either give them to give up the land or to reduce them to a level of where they're nothing but obedient. Because for so long Americans have been misled and are misinformed, I think the language that you talked about, while pretty accurate, might turn off a lot of people that we are trying to reach. So we're trying to reach them by just the International Solidarity Movement, I know, is just trying to give them firsthand accounts of what's happening and trying to relate to them on a very person-to-person basis. I know most people tend, when they hear extreme language, as true as it might be, they'll just shut it out. And so we're trying to really reach out to them and tell them, this is what we're seeing, and describing it in those terms, until we come to the point where people are at least awakened to ask questions, and then when they question, can find out for themselves and can hopefully decide to use those terms that you mentioned themselves.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Jackie, you're with us.
Hi. My question's for Hawaita. Great work you guys are doing. My question is, you mentioned the question of Sharon and other people planning to massively transfer, ethnically cleanse the West Bank and Gaza of Palestinians. My question is, do they also plan to expel the Palestinians from within Israel to outside? How far does this plan of transfer, quote, transfer extend? Thank you.
Good question.
Well, we have, at least I haven't seen any moves in that direction yet. However, what we are seeing in the past week alone, you know, we hear a lot that Israel is a democracy and that the Palestinians inside Israel that have Israeli citizenship can participate in this democracy. For a long time, we've been saying, no, they don't have equal rights and that they are discriminated against. And in the past week, we've seen two parties in the Israeli legislative body, the Knesset, two parties, left parties that are headed by Palestinian Israelis, be disqualified from the upcoming elections because they are calling for an end to occupation and because they call for democracy and equal rights for all. And so they were disqualified. So you see that they are being stripped of their rights to even participate in the society that they live in. But any efforts to transfer them, I haven't heard of. What we do hear of, though, is Sharon's efforts to bring in more Jews from around the world. And I know my father's from the Galilee, so my father's a Palestinian Israeli. And for many, many years, we've had our land slowly confiscated to make room in communities for Jews that are brought in from Russia and from other countries around the world. So confiscating the property and homes and lands of these Palestinian Israelis, I don't think is too far a stretch.
We have a couple of seconds more for a quick call from Shira. You're on the air with Adam and Huweta.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I actually do just have a quick question, and that is that I applaud the work that you do so much. My only question is that I've been really discouraged in terms of what I see as a stalemate just because of the leadership of the Palestinian and of the Israeli people. And if you think that this process can move forward with Sharon and with Arafat still in power, or if we need new leadership on both sides where the bad blood doesn't run so deep and so personally as it does with these two particular men, maybe newer leaders from newer generations on both sides.
Good question, Shira. Okay, we have a minute left.
You know what? I don't know. I don't think Arafat has been a particularly effective leader or a statesman for the Palestinian people, but as far as negotiation goes, I can say that for a long time, and anything I've ever heard, he's been calling for Ariel Sharon to come to the negotiation table, and Ariel Sharon has consistently turned his back. About a month ago, since the beginning of this intifada, Ariel Sharon has said, we will not negotiate under violence, and he has been demanding 7 days of quiet. A month and a half ago, Arafat not only delivered 7 days of quiet, but 6 weeks where Palestinians did not respond to any Israeli aggression. And the international community called this quiet, but during that 6 weeks, 75 Palestinians were killed by Israeli soldiers, and yet no Palestinian responded. And Ariel Sharon still would not come to the negotiation table. So whether Arafat is good or bad is not the real question here, because he has been calling for at least negotiations.
All right. Well, Adam Shapiro, Huweta Araf, I want to thank both of you for coming in tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we now have to go. Thanks.